And I wanted to officially welcome you all to today's internet seminar that will cover, or basically is one of a series of seminars that will be presented over the next few months on CLUIN, called NARPM Presents, where today's session will cover environmental statutes basics. It's been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Dallas. I come out of the same office, and I'll be serving as today's moderator. We will officially begin our presentation with our primary instructor, who is Teresa Joya from Tetra Tech EMI. But before we kick things off, I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeper and reminder items for everyone and give a couple of latecomers a few extra minutes to hop on the line. As a reminder, when you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage or specific URL, which is where you will find a description of today's session, as well as information for myself and our instructor today. You'll also have the access to today's materials from that very same seminar homepage. So if you don't have a copy of the materials in front of you, please go back to the seminar reminders or registration emails and follow the links to the seminar homepage. Again, you can either download the materials or follow the link on the side to go to seminar to look at them through a web browser window. As I mentioned, those of you on the phone lines, we do ask that you keep yourself on mute during the presentation unless you have a question. We won't have a designated period for Q&A because it's going to be a limited audience for today. So feel free to ask a question or make a comment at any point in time throughout today's session. You can take yourself off of mute. Just go ahead and identify yourself and ask the question. But until you get to that point, if you don't have a comment or question, we would ask that you keep yourself on mute. So either use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute. If you have a question, you can hit #6 to unmute. Ask it, and then again, we ask you to go back on the mute by hitting *6. I will provide reminders if we do have problems with that. So again, *6 to mute and stay on mute until you have a question. We do ask you don't put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that could be disruptive. Just go ahead, and if you need to, you can hang up and dial back in. There won't be any entry or exit tones that will be disruptive. So just go ahead and keep us on the line silently and on mute. Again, I would ask that everybody move from the, you should have the slides in front of you. The first slide is the title slide. I would ask that everyone move, return to the next slide, which is slide number 2. If you're printing the slides or looking at them electronically, again, you can just navigate to the next slide. If you have them up in a web browser window, you can use the numbered links that appear on the left side to move to the appropriate one, or you can use the buttons that appear along the very top of your seminar slides. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. Single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. We will also remind you, those of you who are looking at the slides through a web browser window, if you are streaming audio as well, if you have a comment or question, again, you don't have to wait. You can type up a comment or question at any point in time. In order to do that, you'll need to click on the question mark button that appears on the top of the slides in the web browser window, and a new window will pop up, which will allow you to go ahead and type up a comment or question at any point in time, and then I will read that as soon as it's received out loud on your behalf to our instructor. I would, though, remind people pop-up blockers could interfere with that window, so make sure those are disabled, and it might come up behind your present browser window. So if you do click it, you don't see anything, just take a look at your system tray to make sure it's hidden somewhere else. So again, no need to wait until the end. You guys can ask questions and dialogue freely with our instructor at any point in time. If you have any technical problems with today's broadcast, you can also use that same question mark icon to report technical difficulties. You just want to be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached so that we can help you troubleshoot your problems. For all of our CLUIN seminars, each individual participant will be responsible for moving through the materials, just as you've done already, to get to slide number 2. Our instructor will be indicating when to move along to the next page, but it's up to you to click the button or actually physically turn the page. Again, questions can come in at any point in time. You don't have to wait until the end. When we do wrap up today's materials, I'm going to point everyone to two very important links. The first one will be a resources page where you can download today's materials and also take a look at a few other collected resources that are relevant to the topic. The second resource I'll point you to is our feedback form. It only takes a minute or two. We do read each and every one of those, so if you could take a minute or two when we're done and let us know what you thought of today's seminar, we greatly appreciate it. If you're looking for credit or confirmation of your participation, if you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you'll be pointed to check. You can actually have a confirmation email sent to you for your record. And a final reminder is that this entire session is being recorded and will be archived and accessible on CLUIN. You guys should take us about a week or so to get the archive up. You will get an automatic email from us as soon as that recording is available to download, and you are welcome to go ahead and forward that to anyone you think that would be interested in the session. So I think those are the end of my reminders for now, and I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, to the official start of today's materials for NARPM Presents, Environmental Statutes Basics. I'm going to turn things over to Teresa Joya from Tetra Tech, who will be our primary instructor for today. Therese, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Jean. Thanks, Jean. Hi, everyone out there. And today's session is, these slides were first developed by Steve Mason, who is an on-scene coordinator. And they were given last year at NARPM. And they go over the basics of many different environmental statutes that EPA handles. Since we only have 2 hours today, we kind of plucked a few out to talk about specifically. And the two statutes we're going to talk about are the Toxic Substances Control Act and the Clean Water Act. You can move on to the next slide, which is slide 4. Okay. So before we begin, I wanted to talk a little bit about what, is an environmental law to begin with. And it really is not only statutes, but also the rules, the guidelines, the policies, and then any judicial or administrative interpretations of the environmental statutes. This whole body of work is really makes up the environmental law. And environmental laws do a variety of things. They might prevent certain actions. They might punish perpetrators of those actions. And they can also have, in the case of CERCLA, and the Clean Water Act actually have a response component where the federal government is responding. And then finally, most of you already know this, but most of our environmental laws today were the result of some catastrophe that brought attention to a particular problem, and somebody said, gee, there ought to be a law, and so the law was passed to address this particular problem. If you move to the next slide, to slide 5, you'll see some examples. The EPCRA law, which was part of the amendments to the CERCLA statute, was brought about by the catastrophe in Bhopal, India, where release of isocyanate to the air killed over 2,000 people. And those same sorts of chemicals were also stored in the United States. And so here in the United States, they decided to pass EPCRA in order to address, to provide more information to the public about where those chemicals are stored. Of course, the Superfund law, or CERCLA, was initiated really over a couple sites, Love Canal being the most famous one in New York, and also Valley of the Drums in Kentucky and Stringfellow Acid Pits out there on the West Coast in California. So sites like these brought attention to the problem, and CERCLA was passed. The Clean Water Act is actually a fairly old statute in terms of an environmental statute. It was began to be worked on in the late 40s, 1940s. But it was amended and strengthened because a river in Ohio called the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. And it caught on fire because it was highly polluted. And this event caused Congress to make a number of significant amendments to the Clean Water Act. Of course, one of the most recent amendments to the Clean Water Act is by the Oil Pollution Act, and the Oil Pollution Act was passed as a direct consequence of the Exxon Valdez spill and also the Mega Borg spill. And then finally, under the Clean Air Act, the R&P program was started, enacted after a number of deadly explosions and releases in the late 1980s, and that was the catastrophic event that brought about those amendments to the Clean Air Act. So you usually have an environmental catastrophe, and then you get a law about it. I expect potentially that we would see new legislation or amendments of existing legislation, and then the accompanying regulations for a couple big events that happen this past year, the BP oil spill, and also the very large pipeline spill in Michigan. On to the next slide, which is slide 6. So before we talk about TSCA and the Clean Water Act specifically, we're going to do a little overview of EPA and how it came about and when it came about. So on to slide 7. It was created actually by President Nixon through his reorganization plan in 1970. And it was, EPA was created as an independent agency. It is not under any other department. And as you can see, it had its largest budget in fiscal year 10, which was $10.5 billion. And at that time, EPA had about 17,000 full-time employees. And a number of environmental activities were being conducted by the federal government at the time that EPA was created. And so most of these activities were then consolidated into EPA and taken away from the other agencies that used to handle it. Okay, on to slide 8. So here you can see a comparison of budgets for EPA. And it looks like the very largest budget was in fiscal year 10, but it doesn't really correlate with actually the largest number of employees for EPA, which is on the next slide. I'm just trying to catch up online here. One second. And, of course, you know, the news is not good, I guess, for EPA going forward. It looks like there is a big push from one side in terms of the budget to bring the budget back to 2008 levels, which is about $3 billion less than the 2010 levels. So we'll see very, very shortly what happens with that, since I believe the continuing resolution ends around March 4th of this year. So hopefully EPA's budget will be passed. But if you look at the number of employees, that's on slide 9. EPA was actually at its all-time high for employees in 1999. And in 2010 and 2011, you were hovering right around 17,500 or so full-time employees. All right, let's go on to slide 10. Hopefully you have all read the book that is shown on this slide. I highly recommend it. It's called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, and it was actually published in 1952, and it called attention to the problem with pesticide use. And what Rachel Carson showed in her, and it was backed up by research, was that songbirds were being affected by the application and maybe overuse of pesticides and were not returning in the spring, and thus there was a silent spring. It really caused a lot of attention to be paid to the environment, and it is one reason why folks believe that EPA was created and that the federal government started to get more involved in environmental regulation. And then, of course, there's April 22nd, 1970, which was the very first Earth Day celebration. They've been celebrated every year since. It's a day for EPA, actually. Now, you can see on the next slide that had some sort of function in terms of the regulating the environment, and how that their functions were then channeled through to the new agency, the Environmental Protection Agency. So there were, it looks like, 10 different programs going on in other agencies that were moved to EPA. And then, of course, the very first administrator of EPA was William Ruckelshaus, but it wasn't his only stint as the EPA administrator. He did come back and replaced Ann Gorsuch in the early 80s and took over as the administrator of EPA once again. On the next slide, here's a little trivia for you. It has to do with the official agency seal. This was established as the agency seal by an executive order, and it was designed by a firm in Indiana at no cost to the government, and the seal, the flower, it is a bloom which is symbolic of all the elements of the environment. The bloom is a sphere, and the component parts represent the blue is the sky, the green is the earth, and the blue-green is water. And then the circle within that, the whole thing is supposed to denote the sun and the moon. So this has been the official seal since 1971, and there's a policy, an EPA order, on how to use that seal properly. Okay, on to slide 13. Now, President Nixon explained the mission of EPA as being one to start establishing and enforcing environmental protection standards, and also to conduct research into the impacts of pollution, and then use that research to develop ways to respond to that pollution or ways perhaps to regulate what might not have been regulated before. It also had a strong component to provide assistance to others that are also combating environmental pollution, and the major party of that would be states. And then finally, the EPA was to assist the Council on Environmental Quality, that's the CEQ, in developing new policies for environmental protection to recommend to the president. And then these could either be implemented under existing statutes, or it may call attention to the fact that a new statute is necessary to regulate an area that might have been previously unregulated. On to slide 14. The next slides show all of the statutes that EPA administers, either in whole or in part. There's the Atomic Energy Act, the Clean Air Act, CERCLA, or Superfund, EPCRA, the Endangered Species Act, and then many of the FIFRA, Federal Water Pollution Control Amendments. That's also Clean Water Act. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act is also the Clean Water Act. You see the National Environmental Policy Act. And then, of course, there's more on slide 15. Parts of OSHA and the Oil Pollution Act, Pollution Prevention Act, RCRA, Safe Drinking Water Act, TSCA, and then some important executive orders. And these are just three of the executive orders. There are also several others that are that EPA administers. And then finally, because it's a federal agency dealing with laws and regulations, there is a whole body of other, not necessarily environmental statutes, but other acts that come into play. An example is FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act. EPA has to respond to a FOIA request in accordance with the FOIA Act, the Paperwork Reduction Act. So all of these other federal statutes on slide 16 are what someone implementing one of the other federal statutes may run into through their implementation of this. And then slide 17 takes us to how EPA is organized. There are 12 offices at EPA headquarters under the administrator for EPA. And then in addition to those 12 offices, there are 10 regions that operate autonomously. They each have a regional administrator, and they operate the environmental programs in the states that are within their regions. And a lot of decision-making is made at the regional level. The next map will show you where those regions are and how they're divided. And the city that is the central to the region. So the regional office is usually in one central city. In Region 9, it's San Francisco. Here in Region 5, it's Chicago. So this map will show you what all the states and territories, which region they're connected with, and then what city in that region is considered to be the regional office. On slide 19, we're going to switch gears now. So that's our history of EPA. And we're going to just talk a little bit, sort of Civics 101, about how laws are made and then how regulations implementing those laws are made. So if you go to slide 20. So the process for passing a law begins when a bill or resolution is introduced and it's given a number. So any bill that has a number that begins with the letters HR is a House bill, and of course S is a Senate bill. And then once these bills are introduced, they are referred to the appropriate committee for consideration. That committee can conduct studies, it can hold hearings, it can do investigations, and then they issue a report and recommend that the bill be passed or not. And a bill usually needs a positive recommendation from the committee before it would be positively voted on in the House or the Senate. And so the House and the Senate usually work on these issues side by side, and they each pass their own version of a bill. And so that bill is then placed into a joint committee, and the joint committee will look at it and consider it and debate on it and make changes to it. And then once those changes are approved by the joint committee, it will go out for debate, possibly amendment, and then up for a vote by both the House and the Senate. Hopefully, if there can be a congressional conference committee also that's used to resolve differences in the two versions of a bill. And then once the bill is passed, it is and approved by both the Senate and the House, it is then sent to the President. And the President can sign it into law and then the bill becomes an act. The President could also veto it. And if Congress cannot override the veto, then the law would not be passed. And then the President can also just not do anything. And if a law is not vetoed in 10 days, then it becomes enacted after those 10 days. On to slide 23. So now, of course, you know, laws don't often include all the details that would be necessary to actually implement them. And so what the statute normally does is it gives power to an administrative agency, and in case of environmental laws, to EPA, to promulgate the regulations. And the regulations will have more of the detail necessary to actually implement the statute. And the President can also give agency authority to promulgate regulations or to carry them out through an executive order. Now, it's to actually get those details in the regulation, and, of course, federal rulemaking is a lengthy process. The amendments to CERCLA, called SARA, that were passed in they were passed in 1986, and it took 4 years then for the MCP, which is the implementing regulation of CERCLA, to actually be updated to show those new provisions of the statute. So for 4 years, all that EPA had and all that the Superfund program had was the actual statute itself. And the MCP, when it was passed, really had a lot of questions for the agency itself and for the community out there trying to implement CERCLA. But the regulations are a federal rulemaking process. And I'm now on slide 24. The regulations are first proposed in the Federal Register, and those proposals, it has a preamble which explains in detail the thinking behind the proposals in the regulation. And then the public is allowed to comment on the proposed regulation, and the agency, EPA, must then look at those comments, consider them, and issue a final rule. And that final rule also has a preamble, which explains in detail what the comments were and why EPA went with the approach that is in the final rule. And all of those rules are codified and bound up in the Code of Federal Regulations. And the CSR is published annually. It has 50 volumes called titles. And in terms of where in the CFR you'll find most environmental regulations, they're usually either in Title 40 or Title 33. You can see on the next slide that there has been a cumulative growth in federal environmental laws. Again, many of them in response to catastrophes that have happened. Once the catastrophe happens, then a law gets passed, and then a whole set of federal regulations to implement that law get passed. So it's not surprising that there's been an increase in federal environmental laws. They are in response to, you know, real problems that happen. All right. Is there any questions on the little intro?
Again, this is a reminder, if you're on the phone lines, you can simply hit #6 and go ahead and ask your questions directly. Well, Teresa, I think you're doing a phenomenal job explaining everything, and I don't see anything electronically, although I'm sure some other questions will pop up as you go through.
All right, well, let's head into TSCA then. That's the first statute we're going to talk about is the Toxic Substances Control Act. Now, when this material was written, it was really meant to give you an overview of TSCA, even if in your job right now, you aren't really implementing or dealing with much of what TSCA requires. So I'm going to sort of give that overview, and then at the end, I'll try to tie it back to how TSCA plays a role in the Superfund program as a applicable or relevant and appropriate requirement in ARAR. So the Toxic Substances Control Act, I'm going to move right on to slide 27. It was passed because folks asked the question, you know, shouldn't we really know what harm a chemical could cause before we introduce it into commerce? And so this was EPA's attempt to, you know, the legislation passed by the Congress is to figure out how is it that we can regulate chemicals and how they're used in the environment before they're actually introduced into commerce rather than just reacting to what harm a chemical might do after it's already out there in commerce. In order to regulate a chemical, EPA has, under TSCA, can regulate any chemicals that present an unreasonable risk. And so it is up to the company to provide information on what the risk is from their chemicals, and then EPA reviews that information, and EPA's actions can include everything from a total ban on not allowing that chemical into commerce, or actually taking it back out of commerce, to something like a warning label to explain what the risks are from the chemical and maybe how to respond to it if it is released into the environment. On slide 28. So TSCA is a fairly new statute as compared to the Clean Water Act that I'm going to talk about next, which folks started working on in 1948. TSCA was actually passed in 1976. So it was passed after EPA came into existence. And then you can see the some amendments to TSCA based on this slide, so that now it covers asbestos in schools program, it covers radon, and a program for lead-based paint. Let's move on to slide 29. So the Council on Environmental Quality, which is a council that reports directly to the president, originally proposed something like TSCA in 1971. And it took, 5 years to actually follow up and act on that suggestion by the CEQ. And the bill was signed actually by President Ford in October of 1976. A couple things happened in between the first recommendation by the CEQ in 1971 and 1976, which really caused them to TSCA. And one of the big ones was that the Hudson River and many other waterways were experiencing contamination by PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, and there was also concern about ozone depletion from chlorofluorocarbon, CFC emissions. And then finally, the very terrible accident that occurred in the state of Michigan when polybromated biphenyls, PBB, they're very closely related actually to PCBs, they were accidentally mixed into cattle feed when that was not their purpose at all, and then sent out in this cattle feed to feed many beef and dairy in the state of Michigan as well as in other places, and ended up, making their way through the food chain from the cows to the milk to people. And if you were like me and lived in Michigan in 1976, then you probably have polybromated biphenyls in your body from this accidental release into the environment and actually into the food chain. There's a really good documentary, if you're interested in seeing it, called The Poisoning of Michigan, which is about how, the details of how this accident occurred. It's very interesting. So those incidents that occurred between the time when the CEQ said, geez, we really should have a law that, keeps things out of commerce if they're dangerous. And the time when Congress passed it, those accidents giving consensus to passing TSCA. So I'm moving on to slide 30. So Title I of TSCA requires EPA to require manufacturers and processors of existing chemicals to test those chemicals to and report on what health problems or environmental problems they might generate if they are released into the environment. And based on this information, EPA then decides how to prevent those risks in the future and how to determine whether or not that chemical should remain in commerce. There's also a requirement for a pre-manufacturing notice and screening of new chemical products that are to be introduced. So the law looked at everything that existed that had to be checked out to make sure that it was safe to stay out in commerce, and then looked at everything that might be coming in to commerce as a new chemical. And then it requires, those who are going to produce this chemical to gather and disseminate information about that chemical, and then EPA is is the regulatory agency reviews all of that to determine what should really happen with the chemical. Does it need a warning label, or does it need more? So there were testing of existing chemicals that had to occur, and this data had to be developed to show whether or not those existing chemicals present an unreasonable risk. And they targeted large quantity chemicals that were produced and used, which could be very damaging if they were released, just because they are used in large quantities. And when there were no tests existed, then EPA had to require tests to be conducted. So for new chemicals, EPA requires that there be a notification 90 days prior to the introduction of that new chemical. I'm on slide 32. So there's this pre-manufacture notification. A company must notify EPA if it's going to introduce a new chemical, and then they have to provide test data to EPA, and EPA reviews that information to determine if there should be any limits on the use of the chemical, or should they prohibit any sort of activity related to the chemical. And for existing chemicals that are going to be put into a new usage, there's also this pre-manufacture notification that is required. All right, I'm moving on to slide 33. So EPA gets the pre-manufacture notification. The company prepares all of this test material, and they submit it to EPA. And EPA reviews and evaluates the chemical risk posed by the new chemical or the new use for the chemical. And then they make a determination that there is a unreasonable risk, and there will be some mitigation requirements, or they determine that there is no unreasonable risk based on the available data. All right, I'm going to move on to slide 34. There is a screening required under TSCA, and the purpose of this screening is to identify any potential hazards and to control them before use of a chemical becomes widespread, before it really gets out there in commerce where its release could really impact a lot of people. If the data are inadequate to make an informed judgment, then EPA may conclude that the manufacture, processing, or distribution or chemical use of the chemical may present an unreasonable risk. And if a chemical is to be produced in large quantities, then there may be a substantial or significant problem with that chemical. So EPA pays special attention to those chemicals that are going to be produced and used in large quantities. EPA has the ability under TSCA to prohibit or limit activities until sufficient data are submitted when they do a screening and find out that there isn't sufficient data available. So under TSCA, I'm moving on to slide 35. Under TSCA, EPA can do a number of things. It can prohibit or limit the production or distribution of a chemical in commerce, or it can make sure that it is only used for very specific use. It can limit the volume or concentration of the chemical that's produced. It can prohibit or regulate the manner or method in which it is used. It can require warning labels or instructions for use. And it can also require notification of a risk and some record keeping. EPA can also specify disposal methods under TSCA. Let's move on to slide 36. So in the process of administering TSCA, EPA has now developed and maintains an inventory of all chemicals or categories of chemicals that are manufactured or processed. In 1979, the very first inventory was 55,000 chemicals. All chemicals that were not in the inventory, by definition, are new and subject to the notification, which is the pre-manufacturer notification provisions of TSCA. And then these chemicals are added to the inventory if they are allowed to enter U.S. commerce. And then TSCA also does allow chemicals that are used in very small quantities or for experimentation purposes. They do not need to be listed, so there is some exemption for them. And I'm on slide 37. This is one of EPA's, big hammers under TSCA in that it can take emergency action through district courts to control a chemical substance or a mixture that presents an imminent and unreasonable risk of serious widespread injury to human health or the environment. So they have the ability to control chemicals that present an unreasonable risk. I'm on slide 38 now. One big part of TSCA is the confidential business information and how EPA treats that. Companies are having to disclose a lot of proprietary information to EPA when they're doing their pre-manufacturer notification and collecting risk information to give to EPA. And disclosure of this information is not permitted except when necessary in an emergency situation. Health and safety data are exempt unless disclosure would harm a company's business, so EPA can release health and safety data. And it is wrongful disclosure of confidential data can result in criminal penalties, so it's very important for those working in the TSCA program to pay particular attention to the confidential business information or CBI issues. All right, so that's Title I of TSCA in a nutshell. We're going to move on to Title II, which starts on slide 39. And that is the asbestos or asbestos in schools portion of TSCA. And it was brought to the attention that there was the presence of asbestos in many buildings, especially schools. And so they enacted the Asbestos Hazardous Emergency Response Act, or AHERA, in 1986. And EPA set standards for responding to the presence of asbestos in schools and put schools on a track to inspect their facilities for asbestos-containing material, and then to plan for and then actually implement that plan to manage that material. There were no deadlines in the law for completing those actions, but there were deadlines for submitting plans for managing the asbestos. EPA also provided a lot of information under AHERA to schools, technical information on evaluating and abating asbestos hazards. And then also, I'm now on the slide 40, also under Title II, EPA started a program to certify contractors and laboratories that could work on doing asbestos abatement in these schools. So they had a process for certifying so that schools could be, you know, could have faith that the folks that they were hiring and the laboratories that they were hiring to run the tests were on the up and up. This training and accreditation is required of inspectors and contractors and all workers that perform asbestos abatement work in all public buildings and commercial buildings, that is not limited to schools. Title II, however, does not cover non-school buildings. It really was related to asbestos in school program, although by certifying contractors and laboratories, other buildings that might have been undergoing asbestos actions would also have the benefit of having a certified workforce to do that. All right, we'll move on to slide 41. Title III of TSCA deals with radon, and it was added to TSCA in October of 1988, and it is mainly a way to provide both financial and technical assistance to states for the issue of radon. And this was optional for the states. It was not mandatory. So EPA put together quite a lot of information for the community about radon. There is a Citizen's Guide to Radon, which is a technical and outreach piece for folks who are worried about radon gas in their homes. EPA developed model construction standards. It provides funding for technical assistance to states. It established an information clearinghouse, published a lot of public information materials on radon just to sort of elevate the issue so people would be aware of it. And it also established a database of radon levels. So this was really EPA providing technical assistance to mainly states, and to bring about awareness for the potential for radon gas coming into a home or a building. And then finally, moving on to slide 43, we have Title IV, which addressed lead exposure reduction. And it was necessary to speed up the federal efforts to reduce risk to children exposed to lead-based paint. And it was supposed to stimulate private lead inspection and hazard abatement services. Title IV, and on slide 44, Title IV required EPA to develop some definitions of lead-based hazards, a certification program for lead detection personnel and contractors, an accreditation program for lead workers, some criteria for effectiveness of the control products that were on the market, protocols for laboratory analysis, and then a list of accredited environmental sampling laboratories that someone could use if lead paint was an issue in their building. I'm on slide 45. Also under Title IV, there was a clearinghouse established, a clearinghouse of information with regard to lead-based paint, and a hotline that folks could call with questions about the issue. There was an information pamphlet that was developed and a lot of public education and outreach activities, again, just like with radon and asbestos in schools, to raise awareness of the issue and allow people to educate themselves and then decide what they need to do in their individual circumstance. All right, on to slide 47. So TSCA was one of the first statutes that sort of looked into the future and tried to regulate risks from a substance for those substances that were already in commerce, those chemicals. They TSCA judged on whether or not there were risks from them. And for those that were not already in commerce, making that judgment beforehand to determine if it should be allowed into commerce, and if so, what could it be used for based on the risk it presented. So let's move to slide 48. Where am I out of order here? Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped slide 46. So go back to 46. This is probably the slide, if you're working in Superfund, that is most relevant to you. TSCA regulates PCBs. And under TSCA, PCBs were banned for manufacture, processing, distribution, and use except in a totally enclosed manner. And then EPA had to promulgate regulations governing PCBs because they weren't like jerked right out of commerce. They were just banned, prospectively going forward. So there were still a lot of PCBs out in commerce, out in the environment, that had to be dealt with. And so they developed regulations. Those regulations are primarily in 40 CFR Part 761. And they regulate the disposal and cleanup of PCBs. So under CERC law, TSCA becomes an ARAR for you if you have PCB contaminated materials like soil, or if you have old capacitors or transformers at your site that can actually contain PCB liquids. And the spill policy, we used to call TSCA relevant and appropriate if it were for soil, because the spill policy was not yet codified as a rule. But in 1998, the TSCA spill policy was codified, and so it became, you know, an official ARAR for cleanup. And it regulates cleanup of contaminated materials based on the level of PCBs that are in the material that's contaminated. So that tells you whether or not you have to do anything, whether TSCA is going to regulate it at all. And then based on the level of contamination in the material, the regulation tells you how it can be properly disposed of. And then the codified spill policy establishes cleanup levels for high occupancy and low occupancy areas, both for soil and for non-porous surfaces that might be decontaminated as part of the action. So TSCA becomes an ARAR for you generally if you find 50 parts per million or more in soil at your site. If you have greater than 50 parts per million, then you do trigger TSCA as an ARAR, and then you would address how to clean it up and what level you have to get down to based on how you define the area you're cleaning up as either high occupancy or low occupancy. In general, high occupancy has a 1 part per million cleanup level for PCBs, and low occupancy has a 25 part per million cleanup level. Liquids that contain greater than 50 parts per million, but less than 500 parts per million in soil that contains greater than 50 parts per million can be disposed of in a chemical waste landfill. anything that has greater than 500 parts per million, 500 parts per million or greater, should be, has to be incinerated in a TSCA incinerator. So the TSCA regulations do become an ARAR for Superfund actions. PCBs are quite ubiquitous, so you will likely deal with them at one point or another if you are an intermediate project manager. All right, that's TSCA. I guess you can ask if there's any questions from TSCA.
And again, I don't see any online. We do have one question that came in online. As a reminder, though, to those of you on the phone lines, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6. We'll hear a beep when you do that, and you can feel free to ask your question out loud. Okay, and then until we hear a phone question, I do have one that came in from Boston, Massachusetts, and this is in reference to slide number 45. And they're asking, was the Dutch boy picture shown on slide 45 exposing the lead-based paint flavors actually used in print ads? And if so, do you have any idea when?
I don't know for sure. I think it was. This is Steve Mason's photo. It is quite an amazing ad, but I don't know the time frame.
Okay. And again, anybody on the phone lines, go ahead and again hit #6 or just unmute yourself. Alrighty, well, this is just a reminder, you guys can continue to ask questions, or you can type them up electronically at any point. We will be sure to ask them on your behalf. So I think, Teresa, I'll let you continue on. And just ask if you have unmuted to make sure you go ahead and mute yourself again by hitting *6.
Alright, so I'm on slide 48, and that is the Clean Water Act, or better, more, I guess you could, it could be a trivia question. It's really the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. It was first introduced as a comprehensive statement of federal interest in clean water programs, and that was in 1948, and it provided the state and local governments with technical assistance funds to address water pollution problems, and that included research on water pollution problems. But back in 1948, water pollution was viewed primarily as a state in a local problem, and there were no federally required goals, objectives, limits, or even any guidelines from the federal government. And if there was any involvement by the federal government during enforcement, it was strictly limited to matters involving interstate waters, and only with the consent of the state where the pollution originated. So federal involvement in water issues back in 1948, it was very small. They were really just giving money to states to look into the problem. All right, on to slide 50. This is a chart that shows sort of the history of the Clean Water Act and its major amendments. It's been amended many times since 1948. The most significant amendments have really been post-1970, and you can see those there on the chart. The one not listed here is in 1990, and that was the Oil Pollution Act amendments to the Clean Water Act. I'm moving on to slide 51. So in the 50s and 60s, there were four different amendments to that original policy statement or statement of interest by the federal government, and they really shaped how water pollution issues were dealt with. They largely dealt with municipal dischargers from publicly owned treatment works, essentially, and there were a lot of federal assistance to municipal dischargers to allow them to build or improve their waste collection systems. The role of the federal government was extended a little bit during this time period to include navigable intrastate waters as well as interstate waters. So the federal government's role increased a bit in how it defined what it was interested in. It now included all navigable waters, whether they were intra or interstate. And beginning in 1965, water quality standards became a feature of the law. It required the states to set standards for their interstate waters that would be used to determine the actual pollution levels that might be allowed into that water. So standard setting began in about 1965. And on slide 52. And then in 1972, there was a revision of the Clean Water Act. Again, this was the revision in response to the Cuyahoga River starting on fire. It required wastewater to be treated before discharge. That didn't happen until 1972. And making that requirement, it also provided lots of federal assistance for municipal treatment plant construction. So there were many grants, many millions of dollars of grants given out so that municipalities could build the systems to treat the wastewater. And it also expanded the federal role in implementing the Clean Water Act while retaining responsibility for the day-to-day decisions to the states. So the federal role increased, but the program was still really implemented a lot of things. Moving on to slide 53. So the 19 legislative objectives were really very broad. It wanted zero discharge of pollutants by 1985, and it wanted all water quality to be fishable and swimmable by 1983. These goals still remain as goals in the Clean Water Act, and the efforts to actually achieve these goals still continue today. So it was the idea that we would, that the federal government would make sure to restore water quality and then maintain that water quality once it had been restored. Moving on to slide 54. So there are two major parts to the modern Clean Water Act. The Title II and Title VI provisions authorize continued federal assistance to municipal sewage treatment plant construction. So federal funding is still moving to the states and municipalities to help them upgrade or build new sewage treatment plants. And then they also had started regulatory requirements, and those apply and they are found through the Act, and they apply to both industrial and municipal dischargers. Moving on to slide 55. So since 1956, the federal government has been providing grants for sewage treatment facilities. And these grants are now allocated. This program was greatly expanded in 1972, and the money is now allocated by a statutory formula that combines two factors, the state population and an estimate of the municipal sewage treatment funding needs derived from a biennial survey that is conducted by EPA in the state. So there's billions of dollars that are available for this infrastructure improvement, and there is a formula for allocating that money. Moving on to slide 56. The 1972 provisions of the Clean Water Act also started a concept that is in alive today, and that concept is that all discharges to the nation's waters are unlawful unless they are authorized by a permit. And so this was the idea that in order to discharge into surface water, you must have a permit. And it requires then the state to get involved in setting those discharge limitations and industries to apply to have a permit for their discharges. There are more than 65,000 industrial and municipal dischargers that have to obtain these permits from EPA or a qualified state. They're called the National, it's called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES program. And it's authorized by Section 402 of the actual Clean Water Act. And it requires the discharger, the source of the discharge, to attain either what is termed BTT or BAT, and BPT stands for the best practicable control technology currently available, and BAT is the best available technology. So it's a technology-based program where the discharger has to use the best technology that is available to control their discharge into surface water. The permit for a NPDES permit, it will actually specify the control technology that must be used for each pollutant to be discharged, the effluent limitations the discharger must meet, and the deadline for compliance with that permit. And this is one area of the Clean Water Act that Superfund sites do get involved with. Frequently at Superfund sites, we are treating and discharging some sort of contaminated groundwater or possibly waste. And that discharge to surface waters is regulated as an ARAR under the Clean Water Act. Moving on to slide 57. The permits also require the maintenance of records and the monitoring. They will specify the monitoring activities that go into showing compliance with the permit. They are usually issued for 5 years and can be renewed if the discharge is to continue after 5 years. Now, in the Superfund program, whether or not you got a permit would depend on whether or not you considered the discharge from the Superfund site to be off-site or on-site. So for discharges that are on-site, you would not need to actually obtain the permit, just meet the substantive requirements. But for discharges off-site, you would actually need to obtain the permit itself. On to slide 58. In the beginning, the technologies associated with best available technology and BPT technologies focused on conventional pollutants, such as bacteria or oxygen-consuming materials. The more stringent BAP limitations control the toxic pollutants, such as heavy metals, pesticides, or other organic chemicals. And EPA has also issued water quality criteria for more than 115 pollutants, including 65 categories of priority pollutants. And the water quality criteria developed under the Clean Water Act can also be ARARs for Superfund responses. And that is right out of the statute itself, which says that ambient water quality criteria will be ARARs when they are relevant and appropriate. So this is another area that a Superfund site may fall under regulation under the Clean Water Act, is whether or not ambient water quality criteria come into play with your response action. All right, moving on to slide 59. This slide is very important for those of you who work in with sediment cleanups or in wetlands. It is the wetland permitting process for disposing of dredge or fill material in the nation's waters, including wetlands. It can also cover any dredging conducted in a wetland. And this program is overseen by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they have a permitting process that would need to be followed unless your action is considered to be on site. There's also a whole body of information developed by EPA for the protection of wetlands in accordance with an executive order issued by the president. Moving on to slide 60. This is a very brief slide on non-point sources of pollution, and it states that they are primarily regulated by the states. So if you're doing construction at a Superfund site, they may come into play as a state regulation requiring stormwater, management of stormwater runoff or erosion control. And then finally, there's the whole portion of the Clean Water Act that deals with discharges of oil, and Clean Water Act hazardous substances to navigable waters. And with the amendments from the Oil Pollution Act, they now cover in detail what is required when you store oil and transport oil in vessels. And there's reporting requirements under the Clean Water Act. It establishes, interestingly enough, the National Contingency Plan, which is the implementing regulation for this portion of the Clean Water Act, is also the implementing regulation for CERCLA. But the NCP existed before CERCLA was passed, and it existed to implement this the oil provisions of the Clean Water Act. So there was a national response center that was established. It is still there. It is manned by the U.S. Coast Guard, and it distributes the spill reports that come into it to the correct EPA region or U.S. Coast Guard captain of the port, depending on where that oil has been released. On to slide 62. And then, of course, there is federal removal authority, and that federal removal authority actually started under the Clean Water Act for the president to respond to ensure the effective cleanup of any oil or hazardous substances that are discharged into navigable waters and that could affect the adjoining shorelines to the navigable waters. It required the president to establish the position of on-scene coordinator, and on-scene coordinators can come from EPA and the Coast Guard, to direct all actions for the removal of a substantial threat to public health or welfare. And again, that is from oil or Clean Water Act hazardous substances that may be discharged into navigable waters. So EPA or the Coast Guard provides the on-scene coordinator. That on-scene coordinator is responsible for directing all actions and for making a decision to sort of federalize the response and actually conduct actions themselves using federal dollars. And moving on to slide 63. The president was required by the Clean Water Act to prepare a national contingency plan that discussed and described, established the framework for responding to discharges of oil and hazardous substances to navigable waters. And the NCP then provides a system of response at both the national, state, and local level to ensure that discharges to surface water are contained, and that dispersants are used in accordance with the regulation, and that the removal of oil and hazardous substances is conducted as quickly and as efficiently as possible. It required EPA to establish a schedule for the use of dispersants. This schedule is actually subpart J of the National Contingency Plan. It also required the states to participate in the response process, and it sets out a framework for how that occurs in the National Contingency Plan. And then for a pre-designation of the federal on-scene coordinator for every area that's identified in area contingency plans, which flow from the National Contingency Plan, and talk about response activities in a particular area. So there is a federal on-scene coordinator available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to respond and direct all of these activities for the for addressing discharges of oil. And moving on to slide 64. So if you are an on-scene coordinator on this call, you are directly responsible for responding to oil discharges. But if you're a remedial project manager who is also in the response support corps, then you will become very familiar with how these responses are implemented, because you'll likely be called out to assist with implementing large responses that require a very large incident command system and a large number of people to actually implement. Another aspect of the Clean Water Act is kind of planning and prevention aspect. The Act does require the development of several types of plans. There's the SPCC plan, which is the Spill Prevention, Countermeasure, and Control plans, and they're required for the for facilities that store oil, which could be released. And then for those facilities that store large amounts of oil, they also have to put together a facility response plan, or an FRP. There are also vessel response plans. And that lays out how that facility intends to provide all of the manpower and equipment necessary to address their worst-case discharge. And they put that scenario together in their facility response plans and then show how their facility response plan will have efficient and quick response to any discharge. So the Clean Water Act really becomes important for you in a couple of ways as an RPM. Through the NPDES discharge requirements, if you're going to be treating and discharging a waste stream to surface water, it is if you're doing any work with in regard to wetlands, the Clean Water Act will be a potential AWR for you, as well as any ecological work. Clean Water Act will also be an AWR for you. And then finally, in your capacity as an on-scene coordinator or as a remedial project manager who is also in the response support corps, you may get involved with responses to oil discharges like BP or like the Enbridge spill in Michigan this summer. Well, that is all I have on the Clean Water Act. I know I finished a little early here. Are there any questions?
Again, this is a reminder, if you're on the phone lines, you want to go ahead and hit #6 to ask your questions by phone, or simply take yourself off of mute if you use your own mute button. I think you must have done a phenomenal job, because I don't see any electronic questions coming in, and we did have an audience turnout of about 40 people for today.
Oh, wow.
So again, if you have any questions or comments, Therese, just, you know, one of our participants did email me with a little bit of additional information and background on that Dutch boy ad that was on slide 45.
And yeah, I see that
as well. But just double checking again, if you have a question or comment, if you're on the phone, hit #6 or use your unmute button if that's what you started with. All right, and I don't see, again, anything coming in electronically. So, Therese, did you have any final or closing comments that you wanted to make?
No, I think I've said all I can say about Tosca and clean water.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much. With that, I'm going to direct everybody then to move on to the final slide for today's presentation, which is slide number 66. And on that slide, you'll see those two links that I was referencing earlier today. And that particular slide, the first one you'll see is a link to our additional resources page, which is a collection of not only today's PowerPoint presentation materials, but other resources that are relevant to our topic. And if you're looking to download a copy, you can certainly follow the link to resources to get a copy of either PowerPoint or PDF. The other link that you'll find on slide 66 is a link to the feedback form. And again, if you're participating and looking to keep records or get credits, while we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PDHs here through CLUIN, sometimes individual participants will keep copies of registration, a copy of the materials or the PowerPoint presentations, and a copy of a confirmation message that they get after they submit feedback and submit that to the accrediting organization to receive credit for participating. So if you are looking for that type of a confirmation email, you'll want to be sure to follow the link to the feedback form for today's seminar. It's very short, just a few questions. I do read each and every one of those, so if you'd like to see future deliveries like this, I would encourage you to take a minute. Be sure to check the box and have a confirmation email sent to you for your records. If you happen to share the line with a few people, don't worry. When one person fills out the feedback form, you'll be prompted and see a link as soon as they submit their feedback to let another person fill out the form from that same computer. The other thing is the feedback form is available from the bottom of the seminar homepage, so if you just have a print copy in front of you, you can certainly go back whenever you have a moment to the seminar homepage and follow the links either on the side to feedback or the links at the bottom of the homepage to the feedback form. So again, I don't see any other questions or comments. I don't hear anybody wrestling up on the phone. So I wanted to thank everybody for participating today, both our organizers and our presenter from Tetra Tech, as well as our attendees who found time to fit us in. I want to remind everyone that this is just the first in a series of events that will take place throughout CLUIN, where NARPM, the National Association for Remedial Project Managers, will be presenting topics from previous conferences. This is the first session in that series. The next one will actually take place later on this week. And in this case, the next session will be on February 24th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and will cover RECRA for RPM. So again, these sessions are free and open to the public. You can certainly encourage coworkers or colleagues or anyone you think would find this to be a valuable experience of their time to visit cluin.org/training and sign up for the sessions. You guys will receive an automatic email as soon as the recorded version of today's seminar is available for download, and you are free to circulate that with anybody else, again, that you think would find this useful. So again, one final thank you to everybody who joined us today. I hope that you all have a great rest of the afternoon, and that I will either see or hear from you on a future CLUIN Internet Seminar. This is the formal conclusion for today's event. Thank you all very much. Have a great day.